Yes, in a week when all the major leagues decided to put their marquee games on the same weekend, it was football orgasm for football lovers. For those who like college football in America, it was also a marquee weekend as well. So many things to talk about, so many things to touch on. I don't even think we have enough time to go through all of them. So I'm not going to waste too much time to go into any diatribe right now. My name is Onyekachi. I'm standing in gap for Debor, who unfortunately swallowed a frog and will not be hosting the show today. I have the full repertoire of analysts with me today. Shei, welcome. So good to see you again. Even though Debo is here, he would only be sitting on the other side of the table today and be an analyst. But I won't take too much of the shine. Olawale, I would like to start with you. Say something to the fans. Looks like we lost Wale there. So I'll pass it on to Shei, who we are welcoming back to the show after a brief hiatus. Shei, what do you have to say?
Yeah, thank you, Kachi, for welcoming me back on the show. And hello, sport fans. Trust your weekend went quite well, especially for the Liverpool fans, showing that they are still the second best team, let's say, in the last 2-3 years, showing Man City that they are actually not invisible. Also, there was a fantastic weekend for boxing fans. Quite a lot of top-rated bouts over the weekend, including Wilder, Caleb Plant, Devin Haney, and of course, Clarissa Shields becoming undisputed for the third time. Welcome, sport fans.
Thank you so much, Shei. So many things to touch on boxing. Shei has whet your appetite. I'm looking forward to the analysis we'll be hearing from him, because I was also enthralled by the results we got. I think we have Olawale back. So Olawale, if we are back, say something to the fans before we get this show.
Yeah, hello sporting fans. Hello sporting fans. Welcome to the show. I'm not happy with the Premier League and the La Liga sandwiching the, what do you call it, the El Clasico in between multiple Premier League games and the Man City game. We the viewers, Liverpool City game, sorry. The viewers are the losers, because we couldn't really watch the games, especially the El Clasico, the way we actually wanted. About the time El Clasico was about to start, that was when the Arsenal game, the United game, the Chelsea game were probably drawing to an end. And you still want to have a bit of high on those games. You want to know how it ended. And by the time you probably settled down to watch the El Clasico, it was about the time when, I think when the El Clasico got to around 67, 70, something, that was when I think things can be out. I understand probably the data might probably prove that there are more viewers coming from either Asia, but I'm sure the reason why that game was played at 3 p.m. West African time probably is because of most people from either South Asia or North Asia. But whichever way, welcome to the show, sporting fans. I hope you are going to have a nice time with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Wale. In a capitalist environment where it's all about viewership, it's inevitable that we would have this clash of games. But I agree with you that the viewers are the losers. I had to settle for watching one on the big screen and one on a tablet. And it wasn't the best experience for me as well. For our listeners, you will not hear Debor say anything. I'm just only going to ask our viewers to watch him wave to them, to let them know he's alive and he has not been kidnapped by Kachi. But Debor, if you just want to say a quick word before we get this show started.
All right, perfect. Welcome to the show, viewers across the globe. El Clasico. What happened at Ella Road, if it happened in Africa, there will be a big shout. But we're not going to hear anything about it because, of course, he's in England. Welcome to the show and hope you enjoy a good one with us today.
Thank you so much. Yes, that was the longest 90 minutes of football I ever saw in my life, coupled with the power outage and whatever happened. But we will get to that when we get to the football segment. Thank you, guys. It's so great to have you. It's also a pleasure being your host for the day. I want to jump straight into it. Like I said, so many things to talk about. And I think it's the best place for us to start, probably so that we can breeze through it, is the world of basketball. The NBA, the new NBA season tips off in 48 hours. But we've seen so many things happen during this, the slew of preseason games we've seen. But I think the first thing we should talk about, because I think that was what we settled on last weekend, was the old Golden State Warriors debacle. We saw things happen. Olawale, Stephen Kerr came out to say he was not going to suspend Draymond Green. Instead, he was going to be fined. Draymond will be available even for ring night, which is the opening night against the Lakers. But they now took a step further. The Golden State Warriors, over the weekend, signed both Jordan Poole and Anthony Wiggins to max four-year contracts valued at $140 million apiece. Now, I have two questions for you. The first is, for a team that is already paying the luxury tax, why would they take this extra step to further commit and further dig a deeper luxury tax hole for themselves? Couldn't they have just let one go? Or do they really think that this team has the potential to repeat? I think that's the logic around it. The second thing is, on the back of this whole sucker punch by my very good friend Draymond Green of the new media age, what do you think will happen to the chemistry of Golden State Warriors? Hello, Ali. Hello, Ali. Not sure if Hello. Yeah. So, what? Those two questions are directed at you. Why would the Golden State Warriors further dig a deeper luxury tax hole for themselves by signing Wiggins and Jordan Poole to these max deals? And secondly, did they sign Jordan Poole too early? Do you think there would be an issue with their chemistry, considering what happened between him and Draymond Green?
Yeah, I don't think they signed Jordan Poole too early. I think prior to this, look at you, can you hear me?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So I think prior to this, I think the Warriors have done their evaluation of who and who is on the line for a contract extension. I think prior to the whole fight, I'm sure the Warriors have already prioritized signing Jordan Poole and Wiggins. And it just only makes sense considering their age and considering the fact that, considering their contribution to the championship run last season, Wiggins, especially for the defensive end, Poole being more of the second scorer to Steph Curry. So I think they already made this decision, not today, not yesterday. I think probably immediately the season, last season ended. I think that was where they've already prioritized how they wanted. And of course, they have a reasonable chance of probably still having a shot at the, what do you call it, at the title. If you look around the league, you can probably pick one or two, three teams in the East that will give them the run for their money. But we are still ranking the team in the West today as it stands. If they are not number one, they will still be number two. So I think they've given themselves chances of winning something. If eventually it doesn't work out, it's all about moving. So of course, it might be difficult to move a big contract, but I think they've gained a lot from this call than not probably risking something for Steph Curry. Probably at least if you can still win one championship in 3 years, that's the side. Oh, sorry, I didn't get the second question on Draymond Green.
No, my question on Draymond Green is, you touched on it that they did not sign him too early. But my take really was, won't this affect their chemistry? We know it's an axe to grind. I mean, Jordan Poole was publicly embarrassed.
KD said what happened between him and Draymond Green some couple of seasons ago is something that happens every day in virtually everything. People trash talking themselves, getting angry. But for a guy going after another guy with that kind of punch, he has never seen that before. I think it will be difficult. The Warriors not suspending Draymond, I think it's a bit disappointing from my own end, but I think it is part of their plan to see how to probably move the team forward.
Mm-hmm.
On one end now, Jordan Poole has gotten his contract, which means he is valued.
He's paid. Yeah.
On the other hand, even though Draymond Green committed a great offense, he has not been suspended, which means he is valued. Probably this makes
Kevin Durant and the Warriors
dialogue a little bit more easier. With both parties feeling they are going to they are being valued by the organization. It's going to be difficult, but someone said if there is any organization you can trust to get out of this kind of crisis, it is the Warriors. Mm-hmm. So, but I think the Warriors probably don't have Draymond Green as part of their
You took this out of my mouth.
Most likely, just for this coming season, so that's what I say about the whole thing.
Lawale, you couldn't have said it any better. I think what the message I got from it was, Draymond, you have served us well, but you are not part of our plans moving forward. Draymond, at the end of this season, next season, Draymond will be entering into the final year of his current deal. And I personally do not think that he will continue as a Warrior. But we'll wait and see how that will pan out. Devo, I have a very short question for you, still on basketball, before we move to the next segment. And it's about your beloved LA Lakers. Now, every listeners and viewers know how much we trash talk the Sacramento Kings. I mean, we've always said if you want your career to die, if you are just there to make your money and you don't want to compete, you go to the Kings, you know. But in the recent last preseason game the Lakers played, not only did they lose to the Kings, they were blown out. Now, in that game, we saw so many things, and this has transpired throughout the course of the preseason. Russell Westbrook not coming into the huddle when Pat Bev calls for a huddle to discuss tactics. Russell not being there when they are calling out the team at the start of each game. Is it too early to already call this season the 20th season for LeBron James, and perhaps the season where he will get that singular coveted title of being the player with the highest points total, passing the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Should we already call this season a lost season from what you have seen? Just from your eyeball test, is this Lakers season a lost one?
Honestly, I wouldn't say it's lost yet, but being blown away, like you said, by the Sacramento Kings by 37 points, that's crazy, and it's something to fear. And I'm pretty sure we did a good analysis of it on this show last season as well. We cried out during the preseason of Lakers last season that things are not looking so good for them. And as it turned out, it did not look so good. It did not happen well for them. And Kachi, this is the worst part of it. Both AD and LeBron dropped double points, mm-hmm. double digits of points mm-hmm. in this game.
Mm-hmm.
So both of them had a decent or a good game, so to speak, even by their standards. Mm-hmm. But what happened to the supporting cast? They did not come to the party. If this is what we are going to see in the season, then there's a lot of issues for them going into the 2010 season for the game, honestly.
And a very interesting one is that between Pat Bev and Russell Westbrook, they finished with a total of about 4 points.
and of course, they are the new two best friends. But back to the other question. Ross said when Pat was calling for the Odu, the defensive tactic Odu, he was being called aside by one of the coaches. Whether that is true or he was just ignoring Pat Bevin, we'll get to see that. But honestly, I think for them to do anything reasonable, Ross Westbrook should not be the starting five into the season, going into the season.
I personally don't think it will. I think part of what we have seen as a fallout of the preseason was the coach Devin Ham trying out Russell Westbrook as a point guard for the B team. And when he was asked if that was a demotion, he said no, it was not a demotion, but a realignment. I think the handwriting is on the wall for Russ. It's a case of you either fit in with the program or you will go to the Sacramento Kings, figuratively. I'm not saying literally. But thank you very much, Debo, for that. In other news, Giannis Antetokounmpo came out to say he wasn't really worried about the 0-5 preseason starts for the Milwaukee Bucks, saying that they will be very good when the season itself starts. And I also think nobody should really worry about that until we see what the season itself brings. I'm going to segue out of NBA and move straight into boxing. Now, and I'll start with the women's side of boxing. The women's boxing was put under the headlights and they shone, and it shone brighter than the sun. Over the weekend, Clarissa Shields had a rematch against the one person who had defeated her before to unify the belts, particularly against Vanessa Marshalls. And at the O2 Arena in the United Kingdom, we had 20,000 screaming fans. It was not a snooze fest. Shay, I want you to first of all analyze this bout, and secondly to tell me what this implies. What is the implication? We know that women's boxing, at least from in my own part, the first time it came to my attention was when Muhammad Ali's daughter Layla was competing, and it never took off. But in Clarissa Shields, in Vanessa Marshall, it looks like that sport or that aspect of that sport is going to almost be like women's tennis. Fantastic talents coming out, and not maybe one person dominating like Clarissa Shields has dominated. So two questions for you. How did you see that fight? And secondly, what does this mean? Do you think they did enough to inspire the younger kids to aspire to become boxers in the future?
Kachi. I almost said Debo, imagine. Anyway.
not a problem. I'll take it.
So thank you very much for the question. I think they did quite enough to inspire. I'll start from that angle, to inspire the next generation. Also, I think the promoters did a fantastic job.
Absolutely.
The build-up to this particular bout was massive. Guess what? The bout was supposed to take place, I think, like about 3 or 4 weeks ago, thereabouts, before the Queen died. So they had to postpone it that particular weekend because all sporting events were postponed at that moment. Before they scheduled to this new date. And even as at that time, the build-up was massive. I think the promotion for female boxing is actually coming into the bigger light as it is at the moment. And having up to 20,000, I think more than 20,000 fans, yes, in the O2 Arena, yes, for a female boxing, this is the height of it. And that is in the UK. Clarissa Shields came in from US. She's an American to fight Savannah Marshall.
Yeah.
Who happened to both of them? They've actually had quite a little bit of beef over the years, because I think they met in the amateurs, and Savannah happened to be the better boxer at that time. Point. But on the night, it was only going to be one winner. We can clearly see that Shields have actually developed over the years, and she got business as early as possible. She was winning the fight as early as the sixth round, and it was too late for Savannah Marshall to pick up. And even as much as she was trying to take those later rounds, Clarissa Shields was responding equally to those late rally from Savannah Marshall on the night. At the end of the day, it's good to see two boxers, to see mutual respect from the two boxers that actually said a lot about each other before the bouts, to hug, and actually Savannah Marshall calling Clarissa Shields the greatest woman of all time. It was a spectacle for boxing fans.
Thank you so much. I'm still staying on boxing. I'm sorry, Shay. I want to give you like a triple dose of question before I go to my other analyst. Still staying on boxing. I think we also saw a fight in Australia. It was also a rematch between Devin Haney and George Kambosos. This fight also was won by Devin Haney unanimously as well. But two things. Can we just say right now, the only way we would take Devin Haney more serious than we are taking him now is that he has to fight Lomachenko. Do we need to have that fight? Or am I reaching too far for Devin Haney to stake his claim by having a fight against Lomachenko? That's one. No, or maybe I think I should let you go with that first, and then I will follow up with the second question. What would you say?
Debo, I think the lightweight division is turning into somewhat one of the most interesting division.
It's the new heavyweight now for me.
I'm telling you, it's actually getting to it, because you actually mentioned Lomachenko, and I think you have forgotten that Giovanta Davis Tank is also in this division.
I have forgotten that.
Yeah, it's a crazy division, and this guy that had to vacate his belt in the lower division is actually coming up into this particular division. Probably I will recall his name before the end of the show. He vacated his belt like two months ago. Because of being overweight. So his response is that he cannot actually, health-wise, it's not good for him to keep that particular weight. So he needs to step up to the next weight, which is this particular weight. And we have so much fantastic boxers. I think Devin Haney being undisputed right now, he deserves it. He's one of the best in that division. But until he fights Lomachenko and probably Giovanta Davis, I think we can't say he's the best in that particular division. Much respect to him. He has taken on everybody. He's undefeated. But we are talking about other three undefeated boxers, which have done equally, a fantastic job over the years.
Thank you so much. Olaole, I think I'll come to you. Let me let Shehi gather his thoughts. But also this weekend, we saw the return of Deontay Wilder, the one-trick pony, in my opinion, and one-time best friend of Debo. Wilder came back and, set up a fight with Helenas. And, unfortunately, for those who paid for the PPV and those who bought the tickets to see the they fight live. I guess the only saving grace was that one of the undercard was the fight by Caleb Plant. I think Caleb Plant was on the cards before the main event. But Wilder returned and finished this bout before the end of the first round. Okay. Now, that is not even the question for me, because I personally believe that Wilder just goes around. I personally believe he's getting his retirement savings funds up by just picking fights now against people he would beat and can beat. But now, during our production call, Debo, ever the instigator, came out to say Deontay Wilder is the second best heavyweight fighter behind only Tyson Fury. So that is my question to you. How true do you think that statement is? Considering the people right now, Wilder doesn't even hold any belts, number one. Alexander Usyk is there. The fine boy from Ijebu Ode is still there, even though we don't rate him high. How true is it that Wilder is the second best fighter right now? Vale.
Okay, so now let me take it from that Ijebu Ode boy. Let's say how the way we viewed Ijebu Ode boy. I'm sorry, is it the Shagamu boy?
The Shagamu boy.
Yeah, it's from Shagam. It's from Shagam, please.
Some few months back, it's probably different from the way we are seeing him now. And some people will probably have to consider him as a great fighter. If we go back to the
Fury Trilogy.
Yeah, before the first fight, I was Wilder viewed. I think going to the first fight, some people probably, I think probably a majority probably gave the fight to Wilder. Wilder was just probably badly exposed by the Gypsy King. And he has only lost to the Gypsy King until probably he loses to another person. And for the other guys
I don't think you can consider
Anthony Joshua a better fighter than him as that way. Do you?
No, I don't. I agree with that. Yes. But I personally believe that Alexander Usyk is a better fighter.
That is why I think to answer that question, we need to see both of them fighting. I think that is the only way we can answer the question. Whatever we say now looks very subjective. As it stands, it looks very subjective. Until we see both fighting and probably see what, let's see who can. Because a lot of people still believe Joshua didn't handle the fight with Usyk very well. That it could have done better, especially with the second fight.
Mm-hmm.
So, is it that Joshua is the one making Usyk look like the way we are perceiving him? Or do we really think he's actually better than Wilder? It was Wilder probably lost to the undisputed champion, of course, and which is the only person that's beaten him. So I think for me, I won't say he is better than Usyk or Usyk is better than him now. Because I don't really have any facts, data to prove that or any. So I would say I would appreciate if we can have a fight between these two, between now and probably middle of next year if it's possible.
And I like how, and Debo used to say this, but now I see what it means. I like how you just sit on the fence without committing yourself to anything. I agree that yes, we can only resolve this when they probably meet each other. I think this is my own hierarchy. Fury is sitting untouched. No one comes close. Right now, on the virtue of what he did to Anthony Joshua, I think Alexander Usyk is second. Whether by much, whether by little, I think Deontay Wilder is third. Simply because between all four, I think the weakest link is Anthony Joshua. Now, there are the Derek Chisoras and the Ortiz of this world. Those ones can be scrapping to enter the gates. But this is how my own top four is. And what makes sports analysis fun is that we get to choose a side. So for Wale not to choose a side in this, I'm giving him a virtual yellow card for that. Debo, I'm going to come to you. I'm going to come to you, Debo. One of the undercards of the Deontay Wilder fight was Caleb Plant and Anthony Dira. The fight was ugly. It was ugly. It was it was ended by an amazing one-punch knockout. I understand that. Caleb Plant establishing himself as a Deontay Wilder in his own weight class right now. But my own is, what next for Caleb Plant? Because it looks like, I guess my question really is, and Shay, feel free to chip in. Should Deontay Wilder, should Caleb Plant be an undercard? Because I think he's an amazing boxer. He should be having his own main card. But is it that the boxing world is not taking him serious? What does he need to do to be taken serious? Maybe I'll let Shay start and then Debo, you can chip in.
Okay, before Shay talks, please. I have to chip into the Wilder
ranking.
For me, the ranking is still definitely gonna be Tyson Fury is the best among all of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll closely follow him. Closely follow him would be Wilder because of what Wilder can do. And like Tyson will always say, you have an idea until you get hit by the first punch. That's when you know you don't have any idea again.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not even rank Anthony Joshua as the third best or the fourth best. I'll put Usyk by virtue of beating Joshua on top place. And Andy Ruiz at
come fourth. Come on. Debo.
Honestly.
And, no and way.
This is why I think so. I don't know. I feel only Shay can correct me on this one. And Shay, you are free to correct me if I'm wrong. I feel the only reason why Joshua won the second match against Ruiz was because Ruiz was eating too much pizza and not taking it seriously. If he's all fit and chiseled out the way he is right now, and he took the second fight seriously, there's no way in this world Joshua with his level would ever beat Andy Ruiz. That's my opinion. And for Caleb Plant, he has shown he's the best in his division. And right now, what he can do for me is to step up and try a new feat. If he now fails, he can always come back.
You don't think he should, David Benavidez should be licking his lips and saying, ha ha ha, I finally have somebody to fight right now. I think Plant and Benavidez should have a go at it again. Shay, what do you think? I definitely think they should.
Yeah, you started by asking if Caleb Plant, what next for him actually?
Yeah.
And I think in the world of boxing, it's very easy to get to the top. To stay there is the issue. And I just want to cross-reference some boxers right now. Number one, Debo mentioned the Mexican kid. That's
Andy Ruiz or who?
Andy Ruiz, yeah. Easier. It's very easy to be a champion, but to stay a champion is not easy. So that is part of being a great boxer. So that is why Andy Ruiz, for me, will still have to, learn, get discipline to get there. Okay, to your question actually, to get to the top, it's not easy. Caleb Plant was a champion. I think it was an IBF super middleweight champion before he lost to Canelo. This is just normal. When you lose your titles, you definitely get the backseat. You get the back seat. It has happened to quite a lot of boxers. Happened to Callum. I think Callum Smith lost his own belt to Canelo also, and right like an undercard for the last Anthony Joshua fight. quite a lot of them. So for Caleb Plant, is actually for him to get back to have title fight. And I believe that's why he needs to, you know, take the
card right now.
Yes, the humble pie right now and work his way back up. Anthony Durrell is also not a pushover. Anthony Durrell is actually a two-time WBC super middleweight champion. Mm-hmm. And his nickname is the Dog, quite a dogged fighter. That particular bout wasn't a pushover, and the promo for the Wilder bout was actually that there is going to be like a double main main event. Mm-hmm. But obviously the Caleb Plant and Durrell was supposed to be just a little bit under that of Anthony Wilder. So for him is a fantastic win on the night, and I think he can just get on the horseback right now, fight for the title. You mentioned David Benavidez. I think that guy is a killer, and I don't know. I'll have to pick David Benavidez.
But would you like to see a Plant Benavidez fight? I guess that's the question. Is it a fight you, as a pundit, would like to see?
Obviously, you want to see the best fight the best.
Totally.
I think Benavidez is a power puncher in that division. Mm-hmm. Caleb Plant is a skillful boxer. Apart from him having that knockout throughout the night, he avoided the ropes quite very well. And you know his nickname is also Sweet Hands, which means he's very fast. And that is actually his power. Against Benavidez, let's see what happens.
Thank you so much. Let's see what happens. We'll take a quick break here, guys. And when we come back, we'll go into all things football. I really don't want to talk about the Champions League, but we'll talk about it when we return. Okay, welcome back to our listeners and also our viewers on anywhere you're watching us. Never fail to catch us live on Oban Radio Scope. We also air concurrently on all avenues you get your podcast from: Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Catch us also on YouTube whenever you can. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and also comment, especially when I diss your team. And stay tuned, I will be doing a lot of that. We're going to go straight into football. And I'm torn between starting with a review of the Champions League, simply because my team embarrassed me for the 17th time in Champions League history. But there's so much to unpack from the weekend's slew of games that I think that's where we should start from. And where better to start from than the El Clasico? A game between two teams who were level on points, two teams who I believe hadn't lost in the league all season long, two teams who started in history, they had different approaches to getting their talent. From La Masia, from a team who used to believe in their La Masia products, to now becoming a team splurging out tens and tens of millions of dollars to buy players, to a team who believed in Galacticos, now completely overhauled and only spending to secure the talent for the next 10, 15 years. How times have changed. However, on the day, we saw Ancelotti learn from his mistakes from last season when an unknown Xavi outclassed him tactically. I saw Toni Kroos turn back the hands of time and marshal a midfield with Federico Valverde on the right side of the pitch, bossing things around. I saw Benzema, who is a sure lock-on for the Ballon d'Or and UEFA Player and World Player of the Year, doing what he does best. I saw Vinicius Junior being a pest, running ragged on the left side of that attacking forward. Now, Olawale, the question to you is, was that result, because I thought that Madrid should now experience their first slump of the year, seeing that they've been consistently playing at a high level from the latter part of last season into this season. But that did not transpire into that game. So is this a statement of we own the league by Real Madrid, or was it just a minor blip by Barcelona?
I don't think it's either of the two. I think the league title, or the race for the La Liga title this year, at least as of today, from what we've seen, it's going to go down to the wires. I don't think this game is going to determine whoever is going to lead the league title. These two teams prior to now, they've proven to be very consistent. I think Barcelona prior to now have only considered one goal in La Liga. Both of them they've won the equal number of games. I think 7-7 or 8-8. So yeah. I just think this on head-to-head, this is yes, it could be a slight victory on this ticket. If you want to look at the whole thing on the part of Madrid, they won the game on the day. Carlo Ancelotti, a coach at this age, understand what he wants from the game. He has mixture of players who can virtually do everything, play on the counter, they are press resistance, they could build from the back as well as a team. They have multiple things, and that team is so dynamic that they just probably knew that at a point in time in the game, Barcelona is going to play into their hands, which was what they did. A little bit of high line defense, Vinicius beating that, they are going one on one with the goalkeeper and eventually getting the first goal. And immediately they got that first goal, I think they were pretty comfortable until the second half, when probably they sat back a little bit and Barcelona got one and they just went forward again and got the penalty. So in the balance of it, I think it's a deserved victory. It's comfortable, no matter what any Barcelona fans is going to say. I don't think Madrid were really under that pressure. They managed the game very well. But yes, this is the first, it's a slight edge. But again, how consistent are you, Madrid is going to be? How motivated and consistent are they going to be against the rest of the league? Is what is going to determine whoever is going to win the title. It will not be decided on the result of the El Clasico. And probably you could understand the reason why bringing in the likes of Tchouaméni. And this season, one unique thing Ancelotti has been able to do this season, which looks very unique, he has not repeated the same set of lineup in two consecutive games.
He's been
mixing those boys up. Today you see Antonio Rudiger pairing either David Alaba or who is the second
Elder Militão.
Time we see Alaba playing at left back, you see the mixture in the midfield. Sometimes they add. I think the smart thing about this is, number one, this is the ultimate thing as a coach probably wants. You have a large squad, everybody believing that at any point in time they are called upon to play. It's not like they are playing because somebody is injured or this, it's because they are capable of playing. And for the old guys, Cruz and Modric, the danger with this kind of player is if you are consistently playing them from the beginning of the season without their age, there is likelihood that they are going to burn out by December or January. So being able to fresh things up, mixing it up with Camavinga, Tchouaméni, and the other guys there. And I think Valverde and Rodrigo has been, kudos to the people behind the scene at Real Madrid. One thing I like about this, their present squad, is apart from the ability in what those guys can do, I think you could see that attitude. There's something about that, their attitude. Valverde, Rodrigo, those boys have the attitude that probably resonates with a team like Real Madrid. They believe they can do it. They believe in their ability. They see themselves like, we are representing Madrid, and this is what Madrid stands for. You see, that's one thing about when you look for talent. You don't just look for talent alone. You look for players who has that mental capacity or who probably, because look at Hazard, right from when Hazard was at Chelsea. Hazard is not the kind of player for this kind of thing. If you look at it, Mourinho tried to psych him up at the point in time. Hazard came out to like, I'm not Messi, I'm not Ronaldo. That tells you who he is. Talent not alone, but they look for the guys with that thinking, and which is what Madrid have been able to do in the past few years. That's what they've been able to do better. And I think that was probably one of the reasons why they won the Champions League last season. That's that mental edge, like, we can do it, we are Madrid. Because they don't have any business probably beating any of those three teams they defeated along the way getting to the final. So for me, I think that will help them. Valverde looks like a strong character on the pitch and off the pitch. Yeah. And I think all this will help them to keep the team motivated. Because the most difficult thing to do is in sports, is to repeat success. And that is why a lot of people credit Alex Ferguson a lot. It's not because Ferguson is not being celebrated because of his tactical genius or something.
No.
Is that his ability to keep his boys motivated every year. Won the title this year, let us go for it. It's going to have a reason for you to, like, we need, this is the reason why you have to win it. The reason for you to win it in year one is different from the reason you have for you to win in year two or year three. And that is what I'm seeing in this present Madrid squad. And that is what I think Barcelona still have a little bit of long way to go. They are not ready yet. They were badly exposed in the Champions League too. But again, they have a decent team right now. But for now, it is advantage Madrid. But I still think the games against the lower teams will determine who wins the league.
Advantage Madrid, and I totally agree with you. You touched on a lot of points that, you know, that have made me think about the questions I want to ask. So during the course of the season, and Shay, this is coming to you. During the course of the season, I personally was afraid for Madrid when they lost Benzema to injury about 2 to 3 weeks. But what I've seen was a Rodrigo coming in and chipping in a goal or an assist every 90 minutes. Every 90 minutes. That is a staggering statistic for such a young boy.
For a 21-year-old boy.
For such a young boy. And it looks like Madrid right now. In fact, before I go to my question, I want to say big kudos to you for mentioning it when you were analyzing boxing, that the biggest thing is to stay a champion. And Olawale also pointed to it, you know, that you can get there first, but to stay motivated to become a champion. I was expecting to see immature 18-year-old, 19-year-old Camavinga, immature Rodrigo, immature Vini Jr., let the success of a double from last season get to their head. But what I saw during the game was, it looked like the Madrid players wanted it more. You know, Rodrigo scoring, kissing the badge, Vini imploring the crowd to come into the game. They played with maturity. They also played with emotion. I saw something that I want to ask. Are the rest of the team or the league afraid of Madrid? I say so because there was a time Benzema had a clash with Freddie de Jong. And as soon as Benzema turned in anger, if it was the Clasico of old, there would have been 3 yellow cards from just that incident alone. But Freddie de Jong literally was almost telling Benzema that, I know they find your trouble, or make we play ball now, make we play ball. If that was the vibe I got, if the second best team in the league is lying down right now, figuratively, do you think we should just crown Madrid the de facto champion before May next year?
No. I think it's definitely too early. We need to also remember that this is a different season, season like no other, because we're having a summer World Cup thereabouts. Not summer this time.
Winter World Cup.
Sorry. Yeah. Thank you for that. So there is a lot of possibility that some teams that will be leading different leagues might just take a little bit of, you know, they might be slow to pick up after the World Cup, because there's possibility of burnout from those players that are going to go to the World Cup. That is one. The second is there are potential injuries that key players might pick from the World Cup, you know, that could affect the remaining half of the season. So I think it's very, very early to say anything about champions for any league right now, including Arsenal, just to mention. I had to keep that.
And I appreciate you doing that. Thank God it did not come from me.
So what I'm trying to say in short is it's quite early. It's quite early for us to say, but I think what I've seen so far in the Real Madrid team, I'll just kind of re-echo what Olawale was trying to say. There's a perfect synergy within the Real Madrid team at the moment. We've seen them lose one or two players, including Casemiro that left that team. Casemiro seemed to be the engine behind Modric and Toni Kroos over the years. He left, and we can still see what the way they play in the midfield. A little bit different, actually, but they are getting the same results somehow. Olawale talked about Rodrigo picking up, you know, I think it was you, picking up goals and assists, even though Benzema wasn't there. You see, whenever Modric doesn't play, you see a Valverde play quite fantastic. So I think that is what we have learned to, you know, to see in the Real Madrid team this season. Camavinga and Tchouaméni seems to have covered up for Casemiro's, exit. So I think that is what Ancelotti has done. He has evolved that team from what they were last season to the new, you know, Real Madrid. But like I said, it is too early to say crown Real Madrid. Anything can happen within the Winter World Cup. And don't let us forget that this same Barcelona is also flying high. They have they bought almost half a team, and these guys are playing this well. What about after they play maybe like 8 months together? So you can't really push them away. But one thing I'm sure of is going to be a two-horse race.
A two-horse race. Debo, just a quick question for you. I'm really trying to make sure I don't get you to hurt your throat. I know how bad that can be. I was right in your shoes last week. Should Rodrigo be on the plane to the World Cup?
Honestly, for selfish reasons, 100%. And given what we saw over the weekend, Everton versus Spurs, Richarlison getting off injured and crying, he probably will not be on the plane again because of the injury. And Richarlison is like the second or third name on the team sheet for Brazil. So if Richarlison is not going, and hopefully Gabriel Jesus is not going as well, Rodrigo definitely should be going. Even if Gabriel Jesus is going, I believe Rodrigo should be on the plane 100%.
Okay, thank you. I don't really talk so much about the game again. So I'll just quickly gloss over the rest of the news in the Spanish La Liga. Over the weekend, Celta Vigo lost 1-2 to Real Sociedad. Espanyol also got a 1-0 victory over Real Valladolid. Betis also won 3-1 against Almeria. I think Valencia drew 2-2 with Elche. Girona and Cadiz also ended in a 1-1 draw. Mallorca lost surprisingly at home to Sevilla, who seems to have revived their season following the 1-1 draw they got against Dortmund. And Atletico, fresh from finalizing the deal between Griezmann and Barcelona, making Griezmann a permanent signing now, no longer on loan, won away from home against Athletic Club 1-0. I'll move straight to England. And Debo, I really want to start with you. Of course, the game to start with would be the game of the weekend, which was Liverpool versus Manchester City. Now, before we get straight into the match itself, or should we even start with the match itself? Too much drama always happening between Liverpool and City. On Friday, the king of Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp, came out to talk about how ludicrous the financial fair play rule has ended up or is becoming, with clubs owned by oil-rich states seemingly having no ceiling to what they can spend to attract the best talent. And he said something particularly. He said, when a club is already the best club in a league and they get the best striker available in the world as their addition, that how do you expect the other clubs to compete? And he threw Man City, he threw Newcastle, because Eddie Howe said, we have no ceiling. We just need to be able to attract the players we want. But if they want to come, the money to pay them is there. Now, I said, during our production call, said, well, it gives me, the vibe I got from it was the famous Sir Alex Ferguson and Kevin Keegan my game. Because let's not forget that Liverpool, whether we want to admit it or not, have so far, after 10 games, not lived up to our preseason expectation. Okay? So, do you agree that this was pure mind games? If not, I guess the question would be, if it is not mind game, should he have been making such a comment on the eve of such a big match, Debo?
For me, if you say it's a mind game, I agree with you 100%. But each time you are playing against a team like Newcastle, PSG, City, these kind of questions will always bring up, especially if it's an high-profile game. Liverpool are supposed to be the second best team in England, right? But they can't compete with anybody. They can't compete with City, basically. And this is coming off the heels of the contracts of Erling Haaland that we saw last week. Mm-hmm. The boy earns a whooping £900,000 every week. Probably only Messi and Kylian Mbappe earns more than the kid in the world. That just goes to show you, Arsenal, like I referred to in our pre-production call, Arsenal victimized Ozil because of the money he was earning. They did the same thing to Aubameyang because he was earning just £250,000. Now imagine a team that pays Alan 900,000, pays KDB like 400 and something thousand pounds every week. Ruben Dias, John Stone, Bernardo Silva, Riyad Mahrez, Grealish definitely will be on big contract as well. You understand what I'm saying? So it does not give you a level playing field. I understand the fact that Klopp is saying this because his season is bad. He wants to get into the head of the players, but at the same time, these are facts. We can't shy away from it. Hmm. And someone needs to talk about it. And for me, it's quite dear to my heart because my team is a victim of this financial play rule. Before the money came into the Premier League, there was Arsenal buying a £10 million pound player coming to be the highest goal scorer in their history. Or United buying a relatively unknown player, getting Laurent Blanc on free transfer, mm-hmm. and the rest. There was still a little bit of level playing ground then. But immediately the money came, Chelsea blew up, City came, now we have Newcastle. You know what I'm saying? So sometimes you see it, but someone needs to talk about it. Because if nobody does, it's going to become chaos in the long run, and there's nothing you can do about it again.
Thank you so much. Someone definitely needs to talk about it. Sometimes I play devil's advocate, but I do agree. I'm not saying there should be no money in it, but similar to what we see in NFL, what we see in NBA, there has to be a cap. I think the La Liga has something similar where a club's net earning must surpass their net spend, their salary spent in a year. Otherwise, you cannot sign certain players. I think such checks need to be brought in. But let's move to the game proper. This was a game that Liverpool needed to make a statement in. We know Van Dijk, somebody said since he doubled for Valverde's assist in the Champions League, Van Dijk lost his aura and he needed a bounce back game. Everybody had given Trent Alexander-Arnold a lot of grief. It looked like Klopp also knew that he could not start Arnold in that game because he needed defensive solidity. I think Henderson played as a makeshift right back in that game, if I remember clearly. Wale, my question to you is, does this game, complete with all the drama, the red card to Klopp, the disallowed goal, which I will say that would be your question on the disallowed goal. But to Devon, to Wale, does this game signify the return now of Liverpool?
Am I going next?
Yes. Is this the as Liverpool resurrected from their slump?
I think it's difficult to judge. At times, there's something that comes with a big game. I think I was on Friday. I was in the office. I was just thinking about the game. Like, despite Liverpool's bad form, something does still just tell me that if there's any team that is probably capable of slowing down Man City or beating them, I probably still look at Liverpool, look at Spurs, probably the way because of the way they normally set up. So, but something you could notice in today's game is a bit of youthfulness in the midfield. Because of energy, you saw Elliot, you saw Carvalho. I think these guys were allowed to play. Were drafted in at least to add a bit of energy, which has probably been missing in that Liverpool team for a while. And so I think we'll probably need to see them against West Ham on Tuesday, and probably over the weekend to really know. I think one good thing that Jurgen Klopp has done is the way he's managing the crisis. Not playing Trent Alexander-Arnold, despite the fact that he was very fit, he needs to probably put him off the spotlight for a while. The way the team started the season affected him, and the constant criticism, I think, is probably already getting to the boy, and that was why he had a shambolic performance in the past two games. So he needs to give him a break. This probably will give the whole team a bit of confidence. It wasn't really that too pretty on both. I think both sides could have probably said, wow, we would probably have the chance to win. I just think City were a little bit too arrogant, and that was what cost them the game, because the line they were keeping, that eye line was just very, very too much. They got a warning the first time, and the second time, I don't think, and again, if we are going that high, I don't think Cancelo had to be the last man, because
last line.
What the same thing we criticize Arnold for, because I've been trying to tell people that the mistake that led to the goal was a schoolboy mistake from Cancelo. He tried to win the ball one time from Salah, not considering the fact that there is a high possibility that he could miss the ball.
Could miss
and
it.
He's the last man. Another player could have probably allowed Salah to control
the ball.
Then, because for me, I don't think Salah is the kind of player I want to fear on the one-on-one that much. He is not like that skillful and pacey player. He's not a Neymar. He's not a Ronaldinho. So you could either stay back, trying to allow your other defenders back into play, at least to cover up before you commit yourself. So the way he defended that ball was very childish. You could actually see the reaction on his face, and the way he probably finished the game too, it was a bit disturbed. Kudos to Liverpool, they won. But to stick with your question, whether this we can't really say. Let's watch them against West Ham, and let's see them against I don't think they're playing by the weekend, because what happened even in the midweek against Rangers, I think three of those goals came within like 6 minutes. It was 1-1 for a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. So we can never say for now. But again, I think it took some decision, which I agree with. But one thing I just want to tell Liverpool, I don't think Nunes and Salah on the same pitch will ever work.
No.
I don't like the brain of both of them. Mm-hmm. Nunes his judgment is bad.
Very, and very terrible.
I don't think I can add that one with Salah. Because I have a reservation about Salah.
Salah's selfishness.
It's not even selfish, it's footballing brain in total. I have a reservation about it. It's just that sometimes when people bring out the stats, you look stupid if you want to argue against the stats. I know I said it once on this show. If I'm playing street football, I will pick Mane.
Firmino.
I didn't write a lot this season. So, but I don't want, but I just think those two on the same pitch is going to be a disaster. Their decision making is so poor. And so they'll probably have to be rotating them. I don't know. So, but good one for them. But let's see how they if they can replicate the same performance against West Ham.
Okay. Thank you very much, Alain Alisha. So my question to you is now based on that disallowed goal. Bernardo Silva during his post-match interview. Even Pep Guardiola said the same thing, that the referee came to both teams and told them, I am going to let the game flow. I would not blow needless foul. And for them, they felt that the referee was not consistent, that he had been ignoring similar incidents between, I think it was Fabinho and Erling Haaland. Until it came to that one, because that led to a goal. It probably shouldn't have mattered if Darwin Nunes had used his head in the two chances he got in the final 10 minutes of that game. One to play Carvalho in, the one he decided to square to Alexander Arnold. Or two, the other one that he decided to shoot himself that he could have squared to Mo Salah. If they are taking those chances, maybe this issue of disallowed goal or no disallowed goal, which it would have been a non-issue because they would have won comfortably anyway. But
no,
we have complained about the referees being inconsistent. Do you think it was a case of the referee being inconsistent? Should that goal have stood? Because let me keep my own thoughts to myself. I'm the one asking the question here. But I would like to hear what you think. Was that a goal? Or was the referee right in going back to review that particular challenge?
It's actually tough to respond to that. But I'll pick it this way. Your first statement about the ref telling both teams that's going to let the game flow. And there won't be needless, calling for those very slight
tackles and fouls.
Tackles or pulling and the likes. I noticed that he actually did that. Mm-hmm. So on that note, if he's picking that particular foul to disallow the goal, that is a bit of inconsistency. Because I saw quite a lot of fouls on Salah that I did mm-hmm. not call up. That is part of the issue about the red card from Jurgen Klopp. Mm-hmm. But that's not your question. And I totally think for that goal, it's a little bit inconsistency from the ref. That's one. Another thing is, I think the ball was also more than about 15 seconds thereabouts
after the incident,
almost three different players had already touched the ball again before the goal. Mm-hmm. And I actually feel for Man City for that particular goal.
the proximate cause. There was no proximate cause to it. It was remote already. It has become an isolated issue. Was it like the one against Man U versus Arsenal that Odegaard won the ball off Eriksen?
Eriksen and sent the pass immediately.
Saka passed the ball to Martinelli. That was a direct,
exactly. But we've always been seeing inconsistency in the English EPL refs. So at times when these things happen, you just want to put it in the bag of, you know, the issuer.
Do you know what David Moyes said after that game against Southampton? He said the guy in the VRA that started with VRA needs a spectacle saver.
Goodness.
Well, coaches have been known to say things when they are emotional, because that was a game against Southampton that West Ham should have won, which we'll probably not analyze that game, but we'll get to it shortly. I felt the single biggest winner on the night was Arsenal, who right now, by virtue of their win against Leeds United, now have a 4-point lead after 10 games. And that will bring me to the game between Liverpool, between Arsenal and Leeds, Debo. I was surprised that you were saying, the referee was inconsistent in the Liverpool City game, because the result favored your team. Now, bizarrely, something interesting happened in the first half of the Liverpool, the Arsenal-Leeds game at Elland Road. There was a power cut, let's put it that way. So the referee could not communicate with the VAR team. And the game was suspended for 14 minutes. When that game finally came, Saka scored an outrageously brilliant goal. When I saw the ball, I thought Saka had to find a way to square it. It shot that ball with his right foot, I believe. With his weaker foot to the roof of the net. Brilliant goal. But beyond that, Leeds had a penalty. I think Brompton missed it. And then the referee gave 6 minutes of added on time. But they ended up playing 12 minutes of added on time, I believe. I think the game was stopped in the 102nd minute of the game was when the referee blew his whistle. In all this, it looks like we're beginning to see a different... It looks like this Arsenal team is for real. There's a good spine to them. This was a potential banana skin game. Riding the high of beating a Liverpool team. Typically, the Arsenal team of old would succumb to the pressure at Elland Road. But yes, they had the moment when Leeds looked like they were going to get a goal back. But beyond that, they stood firm. Should we start taking your team? I want you to be biased and objective at the same time. After 10 games, seeing that maybe not everybody in that Arsenal team would go to the World Cup, and even if they go, they may not all see considerable number of minutes. So it looks like Arsenal will get the core of its own team back and fresh, ready to pursue the second half of the season. Should we take Arsenal serious now and not only say, top four will be a good thing, but even though Liverpool is the second best team in England, Arsenal is the biggest threat to Manchester City's strike. Debo, what do you say?
For me, honestly, I know Shea and Lale would disagree with me. I'm not going to take Arsenal serious just yet to be the biggest threat to City. There's need for improvements and need for more calculation on the part of Arsenal. They were lucky to get away with it. If they had a draw against Leeds, they would have been lucky. Getting a win was a miracle for them. And this is the reason why I said so. Their game in the middle of the week against Leeds and Goma, the champions of Norway, Arteta made a poor judgmental error for that game. That game was played on artificial pitch. Mm-hmm. They traveled to Norway and he played his first team against starting. And something people might not notice against Leeds United is, for me, stopping Arsenal is going to be pretty easy as a coach. And this is what Marsh did against Arsenal. He disrupted the flow of play from Thomas Partey. That is the only thing they did. Pressuring Partey. Once Partey lost idea of how to play, it became very difficult for Arsenal to control the game. There was no control. First half, Arsenal probably could have gotten like one or two goals more. But the second half, it was all Leeds United. If these kind of things, these kind of calls, playing an Europa League, and I've said this on the show before, I don't know why Arsenal is in the Europa League.
What do you want them to do? What do you want them to do?
They can do like a Milan. Milan choose not to go to the Europa League just to concentrate on the league. They built a good team.
But Milan also paid the penalty for that because they were not in Europe next season.
Yeah, it's good. It's better for them. Honestly, going to Norway, playing your first team, getting their fatigue. Arsenal had less than 24 hours between that game. No, less than 48 hours between the game on Thursday and this game on Saturday. Sunday. It showed the way they played that most of those guys were fatigued. It showed on Sunday that most of those guys shouldn't have played in Norway in the first instance. The game in Norway is not as important as the game at Ellen Road. These are the kind of judgmental calls. If this could be cutting vines and they can bring in more bodies in January, then I'll start taking them seriously. No good bodies in January. Zaka has played 53 games consistently. Gabriel Magalhães, the center half, has played 43, 90 minutes consistently. There's going to be a burnout.
Mm-hmm.
How soon is going to be? I don't know. I just wish Arsenal can gather all the points and teams like Manchester United and Chelsea keep losing, so we'll be assured of a top three.
Top three.
So we don't have to play qualifiers. That's what I'm thinking. Anything apart from that is a miracle at the game at Ellen Road. Trust me.
It's always interesting when I hear you talk about your darling team, but I'm going to leave it at that. And I'll move on to Wale, for you. It looks like Graham Potter is now finally settled at Cobham. He went to Italy and pulled an Italian job on AC Milan, even though they were assisted by the referee. You cannot put that on Chelsea.
I think they were pretty fortunate against Milan.
It was the ref that made a boneheaded decision.
I think the red card made things a little bit easier for them. Would not really, but he's settling down. The only thing I've probably seen from him is, I think that's the same thing we know is Brighton team for his life. He switch easily from that either 4-2-3-1 to 3-5-2 or is it 3-4-3 depending on I still think it's early days to judge him or whatever this thing, because I've seen some strange positioning, especially for Sterling. At times it looks like he's playing as a wing back. But so far so good. Good for him. Like I said, I think if there's anyone that benefited from the Queen's death, I think he's the one, because it gave him a little bit of time to let's see how things go by in the next 2-3-4 games. Now they have some serious injury issues in the team. Wesley Fofana, I think he should be back in probably 3 weeks. Rhys James doesn't seem like he's going to be back. Doesn't look like he's going to make
it. Likely missing the World Cup, Kante missing the World Cup too.
Kante too missing the World Cup. So I think they might one more injury probably to that midfield might see them being a little bit stretched. But so far so good for him. They are in a position that I think he wants to be right now. He has probably won all these games. But in general about their football, still not totally impressed. But we have to give it a little bit of time and see if we will see something different in terms of identity of the way they approach the game. Or perhaps a window to do one or two transfer to have his own kind of players in.
Players in, yeah, exactly. That was my point, that these are not players he signed up on. These are players he inherited. And I think he's doing an okay job. Not brilliant, but just a decent job so far. Shay, on the back of the performances of Kepa Arrizabalaga, should Edouard Mendy kiss the number one shirt in Chelsea? Goodbye.
Oh goodness! I think firstly, having two good goalkeepers on your books is never a bad idea. Man U used to have a certain Romero, number one Argentine national team goalkeeper on the bench, deputizing for David De Gea at a point. It's not a bad thing for Mendy to be on the bench, because there will always be days that it will be needed. However, I still think Kepa is prone to silly mistakes. It's only a matter of time for us to see if he's actually that type of keeper, or those periods were just his period to get over the was it £80 million price tag on his 72, right, on his head. He's still the most expensive keeper in the world, I guess. So I just want to believe that he had quite a lot of pressure on him at a point. That's why he was making such mistakes. So if he has definitely, you know, crossed that particular barrier, then I think it might be a long time for Mendy to hold back the number one jersey.
But if
Kepa is still Kepa, it's only a matter of time you start seeing those mistakes.
Before your rivals.
Exactly, those mistakes.
But she, I wanted to add, Mendy is no better. He's not good with his feet. He's always passing.
Exactly. He's not better.
Kepa is better with his feet. Kepa is actually better playing the ball out with his feet than Mendy is.
Yeah, Kepa is better, but I think Kepa also makes silly mistakes. And goalkeepers are more prone to mistakes if they are not that good. The Edersons, the Alissons, they are perfect doing that. Even though they are one of the best in the world as sweeper keepers, they still make one or two mistakes. It's just that it might come in a game that they've already scored maybe three goals. So that's the difference. So Kepa, I think we should just keep our fingers crossed on Kepa. That would be my verdict.
Thank you so much, Shay. A summary of the major scoreline from the weekend games in the English Premier League. We already mentioned that Chelsea won 2-0 against Aston Villa. Arsenal also won away at Elland Road, 1-0 against Leeds United. Manchester United, after struggling to score against Uzoha, also failed to find the net against Newcastle. In that very controversial drama between Cristiano Ronaldo being subbed out or whatever, I don't care. They drew 0-0 at home against Newcastle. Southampton also drew 1-1 against West Ham United. Leicester played a 0-0 draw, I believe. Leicester played a 0-0 draw against Crystal Palace. Fulham also drew 2-2 against Bournemouth. Wolves returned to winning ways, beating the bottom feeders, Nottingham Forest, 1-0. And Tottenham, even though they lost Richarlison, won 2-0 against Everton, piling the pressure on our very good friend Frank Lampard. to the Serie A, the major result of the weekend was Torino losing 1-0 in the Turin derby to Juventus. Atalanta continued their winning ways. Our own Adeyemi scoring the winning goal against Sassuolo. AC Milan won away from home against Hellas Verona. Inter won 2-0, building up on the fine form against Barcelona during the midweek. Against Salernitana, Lazio drew 0-0 against Udinese. Udinese dropping points and moving to fourth or fifth position on the table. Spezia 2-2, and Victor Osimhen also returned to winning ways for Napoli as they won 3-2 against Bologna. In Germany, Bayern Munich won 5-0 against Freiburg. They finally returned to winning ways again. Dortmund looks like Sevilla as Kobawa, or is it Korawa, whichever way you want to put that in, pardon my Yoruba, losing away from home to Union Berlin 2-0. FC Cologne won against Augsburg as well. And to the Ligue 1, I don't know how important they believe their league is, that they can put a PSG versus Marseille after the Clasico. I would have thought that they should play this game early so that these players can watch better games. Instead, they put their own match after the Clasico, after Liverpool-Manchester City. It was underwhelming. PSG winning 1-0. Monaco drawing 1-1 as well. And I think this is where I want to end. This is what I'm not going to talk about. Anybody who wants to hear about the Champions League and how AC Milan lost, it is not going to be on this show. Go and read it elsewhere. We're not talking about the Champions League this weekend. I want to end with this question. During the week, sources came out to tell us that Mbappe, the biggest baby right now in world football, is already regretting extending his contract with PSG and would seek to leave the club during the January transfer. I remember every single person on this show, when that deal was signed, we came out to say that PSG sold their soul to a 21, 22-year-old boy. He said they made promises to him, 24 or whatever his age is, I don't care, he's still a baby, he's behaving like a baby. That they promised him that there will be a number 9 that he can play off, similar to what he does with the French team. That Neymar would leave the team as well, and that all these promises have not been kept, therefore he has to leave. I'm not asking you guys any philosophical question. My question, and I want to hear from you guys, is what do you think will happen? Because they asked Florentino Perez, and the only thing he said was, I bet he's regretting now. So it looks like Perez would not look towards that direction again. Am I being too overcackled, or will Perez go and get his Galactico once and for all? Every one of you, starting from Olawale, please, what do you think? Really quickly.
Well, January is not visible, no matter how he wants to do it. I don't know. How many years did he sign an extension?
2+1.
As a matter of fact, 2+1.
Yeah.
But there's a snag behind that. After 2 years, he has the extension of, he has power over the third year. So he can say, okay.
Technically he has 2 years. Technically he has
2 years. Yeah.
I think realistically, to finance such deal, because this kind of deal is not something you just do overnight. We know the kind of deal that goes on in January. It's practically the most visible time to do this is going to be in the summer transfer window. And considering that there's going to be World Cup in December, too many distractions to get this one done in January. So I don't see it happening in January. If he wants to leave, I think the earliest this could be a reality, because then it will be 1 year off the contract. And it's just probably giving PSG more probably avenue to make money off him. That if Madrid will go for him is another question. I think, yes, if the money is there, they will go for him, because for the fact that Benzema is scoring like this, I don't think you, someone you so expect Benzema to be at this level in the next 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. But my own biggest concern is going to be what we've seen of him in PSG in terms of attitude, the other side of him, the demands. He's not going into that Madrid team probably to even see that his wish coming true, unless mm-hmm. I'm sure, unless he's dropping all the in France, saying that okay, all this childish thing I'm doing, I'm just doing it because PSG is there, they are there for the taking. First of all, one, if he's playing, if he's going to Madrid, I think the only role I'm seeing him playing is to play at the center forward. He can't play on the left. Vini has won the Champions League playing on the left. Nobody's mm-hmm. taking that left side away from me. And they have the likes of the Valverde and the Rodrigo on the right. So the center forward role that he doesn't seem to like will still be the position I think
what you play in Madrid.
To play in Madrid. Vini, I'm saying it once again, Vini is not leaving that left side for a Kylian Mbappe. So unless probably all this drama that he's doing in this thing, that vexing if they don't pass to him, that he's doing this, I hope he's dropping those attitudes. If not, he's in for a shocker and disappointment.
Jay, what is your take on this?
I agree with Olawale. Firstly, I think January is a no-no. And he just signed not up to 6 months ago and he wants to leave in January. I don't see him forcing himself to leave the club. In the first place, we need to also understand that the huge wage bill at the moment, it's not every club that can pay that kind of money. So you can only count maybe like 3 clubs that can actually enter into that race and say they want to pay. Obviously, mm-hmm. right now, Barcelona can't be there. Real Madrid seem to be okay at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Man City, they have Haaland.
And Newcastle.
And I don't think he wants to play Europa. Because I believe Newcastle is not going to play the Champions League.
Europa.
I'm not too sure if Man U is going to play the Champions League. So, right now, and Liverpool does not spend that kind of money. Klopp just told us over the last week. So, if you ask me, I think he's just kidding.
Okay.
That would be my answer.
Debo, what do you say for us to wrap this up?
For me, I like us to do the root cause analysis of it. The boy is, I don't want to use bad word on radio, but the boy is being childish.
He's a sport bat.
He was promised that they would terminate the contract of Messi and Neymar, and that would have cost PSG a whoopee 600 million euros to do that. Anybody in their right senses would have taken that on, like, we'll have taken it with a pinch of salt, that this is not possible.
Mm-hmm.
How many people can afford Neymar in the world? How many people can afford the transfer fee and the wages of Neymar in the world? Even if he wants to leave, the earliest, I don't agree with Olawale, the earliest that Mbappe can leave PSG will be 2024 after his contract is done.
Expires.
Yeah, nobody can afford the kid because PSG would want at least 250 million. To 300 million. How many people can pay that kind of money? Liverpool definitely cannot pay it. Like Shay said, City probably would not be interested because of Haaland, of course, and Newcastle would not want to go to Newcastle. The only viable option that he has is Manchester United. Does he want to play at Manchester United? That's the only club rich enough to afford his wages and the transfer fee. You know, so coming out, and I keep saying it, these players need to educate themselves. This thing does not happen.
Thank you so very much, guys. I really want to say a big thank you. And just before we close, a big shout out to Francis Uzoho, who fulfilled his lifelong dream of playing at the Theatre of Dreams, being a Manchester United fan. He almost single-handedly kept his club Omonia or whatever it's called in the game until he lost due to the McTominay goal. But even during the post-game interview, he was smiling like a child in a candy store, and I can understand
it cost us the World Cup.
Uzor has single-handedly found a new club on the back of that performance, and we wish him all the best. That's it. It's a wrap. I know it took longer than usual, but it's because we have so many things to talk about. I want to say big thank you to Sheyi. Good to have you back. Olale, thank you for staying up this late to have this discussion. And for Debo, I hope you can vomit the frog you swallowed so that you can be back on the main seat next week. It's a wrap from me here, Kachi, signing out, saying keep supporting sports. Goodbye.